Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and welcome back to another episode of New Books in Japanese Studies, a podcast channel of the New Books Network. I am Jeannie Lee from the University of Arizona. Joining us today is Professor Johanna Zueta from Toyo University in Japan. Her new book, Okinawa Woman's Stories of Migration from War Brides to Ise, was recently published by Routledge. It's currently available in hardback and ebook. In this book, Johanna turns her focus to a group of women in Okinawa who married to non-Western men stationed in Okinawa during the occupation era. And Johanna studies their life stories as well as their identity formation through their marriage and afterwards. Welcome. Thank you so much for joining us today again.
Yes. Thank you so much, Jeannie, for inviting me.
You've previously joined us to talk about your book on transnational identities on the Okinawa military base. So how have you been since then?
Yes, it was good. I also gave several book talks on that about that book and on that issue as well. And as you know, this current book that I have, this recent book on Okinawan women, they're pretty much related to the previous book, right, in terms of the population that I studied, how they're related to each other, etc.
Indeed, that's very nice. So what brought your attention to Okinawa women's stories and especially this group of war brides?
Yes, if you remember in my first monograph, I looked at base workers in Okinawa, many of which retired because of old age. But then these base workers were actually half Filipino and half Okinawans, right? And their mothers were Okinawans. So I wanted to focus more on the Okinawan women because most of the studies done on them, especially the so-called war brides, were the ones who went to the U.S., right? Who married American men. There were also, or there was, I think I only know of one, one work on women, Japanese women who went to Australia as war brides. But then because of my work on base workers, I also, on these half Okinawan, half Filipino base workers, I got to know their mothers while doing field work. So I also did research, a little bit of research on them when I was doing my PhD. And then expanded my research on these women when I was doing my postdoctoral research. And then I decided to write a book about them because I believe that their stories need to be told to the world. However, it's difficult because not many of them were not many of them were open about their stories. So even their kids, their children, their grandchildren didn't know much about these women. But then I said, well, I just need to, conduct some interviews, talk to them. so that I'll get to know more about their lives and then eventually tell their stories to the world. Yes.
That's really amazing. I'm thinking that you're working to preserve the memory of this generation who, as your book mentions, we don't have many of these women left. Like most of them have passed away already. Yeah. So how is your book structured?
Yes. What I did was, because I am a sociologist, so I was curious about their old age, right? Their lives at present. So I talked to them about that. And then, of course, I also had to know their beginnings. So most of them experienced the war, which really left many of them traumatized because they did not talk about the Battle of Okinawa, right, during World War II to their kids, to their grandchildren. So not many of them knew about their parents or their mothers or their grandmothers' lives in Okinawa prior to their migration to the Philippines. So I asked them about that. In fact, chapter two talked about this woman's experiences during the Battle of Okinawa. So in a way, I structured it as, you know, telling the story of the Battle of Okinawa from this person's point of view. And she was the only one who, you know, shared about her experiences, because the others, they told me about their experiences in the Philippines, but not the Battle of Okinawa. They just told me, okay, I was born here, etc., and then I moved to the Philippines. So in a way, the Battle of Okinawa was somehow erased from their memories. So it's structured in such a way that I talked about their histories. I talked about the American occupation from their perspective, right? How they met, you know, these base workers. As I've mentioned, most of these war brides in Okinawa met American men, right? And that's why they're called war brides, because they met them in a way during the war or post-war, right? That's the definition of a war bride, especially from a Japanese perspective. But then there's this group of Okinawan women, there are quite a number, who did not marry Americans. They married Filipinos. So I mentioned in my book that they married the other occupier, which are Filipinos, right? So in a way, Filipinos were part of the Allied forces who somehow occupied Japan, right? And Okinawa. And I said, you know, this is a significant group, and why don't many people know about this? I mean, you go to Okinawa, they know about it, but then academically it's under-researched. So I said, I have to write this book. So that's how I structured it. And then I looked at, because their migration stories are pretty much interesting, so I looked at their marriage to Filipinos, their eventual migration to the Philippines, their lives in the Philippines, and many of them stayed in the Philippines. However, there's quite a number also who returned to Okinawa in their latter years. So in their 60s, 70s, right, for many reasons. And there's also this, one of the last chapters, I also looked at the issue of death and burial, which I think is important because it was also pretty much, I wasn't really looking at that, but then these women talking about death, right? They call it the haka, their burial sites, right? It just popped out in some of the interviews that I did. So I said, this might be very, very significant. That's why I approached it from a life course perspective, from their beginnings in Okinawa, their experience of the war, and then end of life. So that's how I structured it.
I see. Now, for those of us who might not be so familiar with this period of history, and for, I guess, more background information on these war brides, so from what time period did most of them get married? And do we know how many of them were there?
Yes. So 1945, the war ended, and then the American occupation army, right, the USCAR, also the government brought in labor from the Philippines, from India, other parts of the world, mostly from the Philippines because of its colonial history, right, with the U.S. And so these intermarriages occurred, I think, late 40s, early 50s. So that was the time when a lot of these Okinawans, the locals, were working on base or around the bases. And most of these women I encountered, the Okinawan women, they were working either as maids, right, domestic helpers for families inside the base, or cleaners, waitresses, right? Some of them worked as store clerks inside the bases, right, the concessionaires. So they met these Filipinos because of their work, because they were working on base or around the bases. And for many of them, because they married quite young, for many of them, it's their first relationship, right? So, yeah, so I think I spoke to, I think, two of them who explicitly told me that, oh, he's actually my first boyfriend, and then we got married. So yeah, it's really pretty much interesting. And then after that, these women went back to the Philippines, or went to the Philippines with their husbands, because their husbands' work contracts were ended or were terminated, right? Some were terminated for several reasons, some just ended and they did not renew it. For some of these workers, they decided to continue staying in Okinawa, so they were able to get jobs. But my focus was on these women who went to the Philippines. So the migration to the Philippines was in, I think, the mid-1950s, late 1950s, so that period. And how many of them migrated, it's really difficult to get hold of the exact number, but there's an estimated around 1,000 who married and then went to the Philippines with their husbands. And then I had data from the Philippine Okinawan Society. How do you call this? This membership directory of the first generation Okinawans who went to the Philippines. So these were the women, and then the second generation, third generation. So I got hold of that almost 20 years ago, and there were around 1,000 women listed, right? But of course, there were some women who were not members. So probably they were not registered. So let's put it to 1,000 or so. So that's, I think, a general estimate.
Yeah, and that's really not a small number. So in your book, you referred to them as ise in Japanese, as in first generation. So for these war brides who went back to the Philippines, or I shouldn't say go back, they traveled to the Philippines with their family. What's the transition like for them to transition from life in Okinawa to life in Philippines? And I guess, how does the identity of these first generation women shape their self-identification to connect with your first book? And the way they position themselves, the way they see themselves within the Philippine society.
Yes. I call them ise because it's how they identify themselves. So they identify themselves not as senso hanayome or war brides, but as ise, meaning their first generation. So it's like I felt when I was listening to them, so I was thinking, oh, I think they're claiming it, that they are actually first generation migrants, that they really traveled and brought along their their lives and Okinawan culture with them. So transition was not smooth for many of them because for most of them, maybe all of them, it's their first time to travel outside Okinawa. And then so you have issues with language, with culture, right? It's totally different culture. Maybe not really the weather because it's mostly, you know, it's almost the same weather or climate. Yeah, it's really integrating. And so many of them tried to learn the language. In fact, most of them are fluent in the language of in some of the Philippine language. Some of the Philippine languages, not only Tagalog. So yes. They also told me that because they were based in the Philippines, they tried to bring up their children in a more Filipino way so as to be able to integrate in Philippine society. And it's, I think, also because during that time, sentiments against the Japanese were pretty much not good because of the war, right? So yeah, and I also encountered some of their children, right? So when I was talking to them, when I was writing my first book, they experienced bullying or discrimination because of their Japanese parentage, right? So some women experienced that, but some said that, you know, they were able to overcome these kinds of experiences because they really tried to know more about the Philippines, right? The culture and the language.
And from another perspective, did you get a chance to see how the Philippine society viewed these war brides at the time?
Yes. I think I wrote somewhere that some of the husbands' families didn't really like the women because of the history, right, of the war. So, and these women were actually seen as Japonesa, or were called as Japonesa. Japonesa is the Tagalog or the Spanish term for Japanese woman. But they're not actually, well, technically they're Japanese, but they're actually from Okinawa. So they were in a way lumped as to this category of Japanese. And for the Filipinos during that time, if you're Japanese, then you're the enemy, right? So there was this... maybe tension or this discrimination towards these women because they were seen as the enemy. But that changed because they were able to integrate and because of historical changes as well, especially during the 70s when Japan started becoming the power in Asia, right? The bubble economy, etc. Yes.
Now, do some of these women return to Japan after all? And I guess what factors decided their choice of whether to remain in Philippines or to return to home?
Yes, I saw some structural factors like the Japanese economy, for example. And then some of them returned because their children wanted to return. Or they wanted to work in Okinawa, and so they accompanied their children to Okinawa. Some of them returned for medical purposes. So I met like some women in their 60s, 70s who returned. Who returned during their 60s, 70s because of medical reasons, and they preferred to be treated in Okinawa. Some of them also returned because their children decided to work in Okinawa and stay in Okinawa permanently. So they said, okay, why will I stay in the Philippines? My husband is gone. So they went back home. Some did not go back, primarily because their families are mostly in the Philippines. So they decided to stay in the Philippines. Some of them also decided not to go back because they became estranged with their natal families because they were disowned for marrying an outsider. So it's pretty much varied. But yeah, if you look at structural factors, it would be the economy. economic reasons, right? And then if you look at more micro level reasons, it's because of the family related reasons. Yeah.
And after they return to Japan, how does this, you mentioned that this, for some of them, their marriage with a non-Japanese person affected their relationship with the family. So after these brides returned to Japan, how did their I guess identity or self-identification change, or was there any kinds of change after they came back to living in Japan? And how did the Japanese society view them after their return?
One thing that's significant when they returned was the fact that most of them are Catholics. They converted to Catholicism because, most of their husbands are Catholics. And to raise their children as Catholics, they had to convert. That was during that time, back in those days. And they became really devout Catholics. So when they returned to Okinawa, they looked for churches, Catholic churches. And in fact, when I did my fieldwork in one of these Catholic churches, the Issei, so they call themselves Issei, many of them didn't know each other when they were in the Philippines because they were based in different provinces. They only got to know them each other at church in Okinawa. And then they found out that they had similar history, similar stories, because they lived in the Philippines. They married a Filipino. They lived in the Philippines for 20, 30 years. And so they became really good friends. And I quoted one of these ladies, and she said that she encountered Okinawans saying that they're different because they believe in a God that's being believed by foreigners. So, Gaikokujin no kami o shinjite o, something like that. Because originally Okinawa was not Christian, right? So in a way, they're minority. The fact that they also lived abroad for a long time and then they returned to an Okinawa, which is now part of Japan and very much developed. So that also created probably a reverse culture shock. Their language was also affected. In fact, one of the women said that her siblings in Okinawa told her that she speaks Okinawan or she speaks Japanese differently. So those kinds of things, I think, mattered in terms of reintegration. But then many of these women also had their families in Okinawa. So they brought their children, or their children came first, worked on the bases, and then they followed. So most of these women returnees have their own families, their children in Okinawa, although they don't really stay with them, I mean, physically, like in the same house. So they have their own place.
Out of complete curiosity, and I don't think your book went into very much detail about this, but I'm just very curious. So when we say Okinawan woman, do you mean in the sense that they were indigenous Okinawan? And as you were talking about how they faced these challenges after the return to Japan, I'm just wondering if their treatment as Issei, as these first generation war brides, did that have also anything to do with the treatment of indigenous population in Okinawa from the mainland Japanese society?
I think it has become part of their identity. They're really Okinawan, so we can argue that they are indigenous, although they did not say the word indigenous. Right, but they say that they are Okinawans, right? Okinawa Shushin. Or some of them said that they're not, they identify themselves, let's say they're from Naha, but in Naha, you also have districts. So they say, okay, I'm from Naha, yes, but then I'm originally from Uebaru, which is one district in Okinawa. So that's how they identify themselves. But yes, all of these women are from Okinawa. So we can argue that they are indigenous Okinawans. They say that they imparted Okinawan ways also to their children. Sometimes food, words, for example, because they were talking in Filipino languages to their children, but then some Okinawan terms or even Japanese terms come up. In fact, I met some Nisei, their children in the Philippines who were actually, I don't want to say fluent, but they're knowledgeable in Okinawan. They know how to speak Okinawan because of their mothers. And they also know how to speak Japanese, the Hyojunko, right? Standard Japanese. So they're pretty much aware that they're Okinawans. And then they tell their children that we are Okinawans. I remember hearing some of these women even say the word Ryukyu. So Ryukyuans. So they're pretty much conscious of that fact.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
That's very fascinating. Thank you. Now, in following chapter, in chapter 5, you discuss the choices these women make when they face their late years and death. So why is this such an important part in the discussion of war brides?
Yes, that came up in an interview because they were talking about, and also some of my informal conversations with them, they were talking about haka, right? They were talking because they're all Catholics, right? The women that I spoke to, and then one of them was saying, "Oh, I already bought like this nokotsudo, this burial vault in a Catholic church. So when I die, I'm already ready." And then I got curious because I said they've been talking about death, so this might be important. And then that led me to really read up on burial, maybe protocols or traditions in Okinawa. And then I found out that because Okinawa is a highly patriarchal society, so if you're a woman and then you get married, so you, in a way, you move out of your natal family. So when you die, you will be buried in this tomb, right, with your husband's family. So that's how it went during those times, right? If you're familiar with the Ryukyuan tombs, right, they're like turtleback tombs, like the Chinese tombs of southern China, right? So they're like turtlebacks. But if you're if they married a foreigner, so that presents a problem because the foreigner doesn't have these tombs, right? Because they're not Okinawans. So what happens, right? And so that led me to think. And then for these women, they also mentioned that one of these women mentioned that, okay, I still don't have a nokotsudo, I still don't have a haka. So I don't know where I will die because my husband already passed away and he's buried in the Philippines. And I'm in Okinawa. I cannot be buried in my family's tomb because I married a foreigner. So she told me about these things, and that's why I did more research about it. And I said, this can really present a problem, especially for international marriages like this, right? Because tradition states that you cannot be married in your natal, your family's tomb because you married a foreigner, and a foreigner doesn't have a tomb in Okinawa. And for these returnees, for example, they're already in their old age. If they pass away, where will they be buried, right? Will they be shipped back, their body shipped back to the Philippines, or their ashes shipped back to the Philippines, or will they be buried in Okinawa? So that came up. And then even the issue of cremation, which is pretty much done in Japan and also in Okinawa now, but back in the Philippines, it's not. It's becoming common, but then people still prefer to be, how do you call that? You know, miso, buried as is with your body intact. So that's actually an issue. And in fact, one of the women who was very much open to me, and then she was telling me, I don't know if she was able to purchase burial vault in a Catholic church in Okinawa, because the last time I spoke to her, she said, I still don't have this vault. So I'm still thinking, if I pass away, will I be sent back to be buried with my husband in the Philippines? So I didn't have an update on that. And unfortunately, she passed away last April. Yeah. And, I wasn't, because she was actually looking forward to this book, and I wasn't able to tell her that it was published a month before. But I think her family cremated her body, and she's here in Okinawa. I mean, her ashes are stored in a Catholic church in Okinawa, and her husband's body is in the Philippines. So that's actually important, because I also mentioned the cost of these tombs in Okinawa, in churches. So if you don't have the money, so it will be a challenge. If you want your body transported to the Philippines to be with your husband, it costs money, right? I mean, if you're transporting ashes, it costs less, but still it costs money. So there are many factors that's not only related to, you know, war brides, but you can expand it to the issue of international marriages, migration and death, right? So especially if you have like specific cultural traditions, like the Muslims, for example, right? That they have to adhere to some cultural traditions that can be a challenge if they married outside a land that is not, let's say, Muslim, or they don't have Muslim rituals. So that can be a challenge.
Indeed, it can be. Now, in your research, you've talked to war brides, you've collected their life stories. Is there one or two stories that really stood out to you?
Yes. One was the story that I spoke about in chapter 2. When she told me about her experiences during the Battle of Okinawa. So, I mean, hearing that directly from someone who experienced it versus reading it in a book is really different, right? How she told me about, you know, experiencing being in a cave and then the family in the next cave, or the cave beside where she was in, was bombed, right? Or people were dying and she can hear screams, or she was hearing screams. So, and she was all alone because her family was separated from her, right? So these are really the voices of these women. So considering that the trauma that they experienced, right? This is very traumatic. That's why many of them were really tight-lipped that even their children didn't know about this, right? So you can just imagine, right? Retelling how they can retell their stories. So that's one. I think most of the stories of the women when they moved to the Philippines, how they endured, right? Being in a different place. And many of them actually were the only Okinawan or Japanese in the community. Hence, they had to integrate in the culture. And I also mentioned one case wherein this woman, because she was isolated, I mean, she didn't have anyone to talk to in Japanese or in Okinawan. She forgot speaking the language. And when I met her, she could only muster like an ohayo gozaimasu or good morning and arigato gozaimasu or thank you. And then because she spoke the language of the South, Southern Philippines, which I don't speak, I had to talk to her using a translator, an interpreter, because she couldn't talk to me in Japanese and I couldn't talk to her in that Philippine language that she knows.
Yeah, there are so many complicated issues that come from this, well, just from their marriage and from the situation that they had to be put in. So in your research and encounter with them, what have you learned about their transnational identities in this sense and their current situation in both Japan and Southeast Asia?
Yes, because these women have been or lived in the Philippines, for the returnees, they lived in the Philippines for like 20 to 30 years. I noticed that most of the returnees there, in a way, they can shift from being Okinawan and being Filipinos. For example, I hear them speak to their children in both Okinawan and Filipino. I mean, Japanese and Filipino, sometimes mostly in Filipino. They see me, they sometimes talk to me in Filipino. And they're even concerned with some events back in the Philippines, considering that they've been back here. So that's one. For those in the Philippines, they are still pretty much pre-pandemic. So I'm talking about pre-pandemic. They still occasionally come back to Okinawa for visits. And what's also interesting, because Okinawa has this Uchinanchu Taikai, the World Okinawan Festival, and the Issei based in the Philippines, they really, as much as possible, attend the Taikai, the festival, because that's a way for them to return, to be in touch with overseas Okinawans and even their fellow Isseis who returned to Okinawa. Unfortunately, though, not many of them could make those trips previously because of old age, right? And the last Taikai that I attended in 2016, I met two Isseis. I've known them even before. They in 2011, when I joined them for the Taikai, for the festival, they were pretty much mobile. But 5 years after 2016, they had a difficulty walking, well, because of old age, right? So, and they were like, okay, can we still attend the next Taikai, which is actually this coming October because of the pandemic. So it was supposed to be held last year, but I think it will be held this year. So I don't know if they're coming. So yes. Yeah, I guess that's so how, that's their transnationality.
To connect this with your previous book and to, put it into a larger context, in this project, you've discussed Japanese war, Okinawan war brides in Okinawa and Philippine from perspectives of the history, culture, and the geopolitical situations that concerned multiple countries and regions and cultures. So this is such a complicated topic, and as you've mentioned earlier, there are so many factors that affected their self-identification and their position in society. So how do you think with issues like this, not just Okinawan war brides, but these personnels that were involved with the occupation era from multiple countries, how do we better understand their stories in contemporary issues like migration, identity, and cross-cultural marriage?
Yes, I believe that migration in Okinawa, if you're going to look at current migration in Okinawa or the current, let's say, foreign population in Okinawa, I also argued in my previous book that this is pretty much historical. It has historical basis, right? Especially with the workers on base, for instance. How come you had Filipino workers on base or half Filipino workers, right? It's not just because of economic reasons that they came, right? It's primarily because of the occupation of Okinawa that these workers were hired by the U.S. occupation government. And this is really, I mentioned in the book, the previous book, that there were treaties, there were letters from the USCAR to the Philippine government saying that, okay, we need people. So we have to look at it in that context, that the occupation is really important. And these intermarriages as well, of course, this occurred because of the occupation. But many of these intermarriages also occurred because of economic reasons, right? That many of these women, they were hard up economically, and they thought that marriage to an American or to a foreigner during that time would probably lift them out of poverty. Of course, we also should not discount the fact that there was, you know, the concept of love is also involved. Because in many of in many academic works, when you say they don't really look at, falling in love as a factor, but it also happened, right? And as I've mentioned, that some of these women, they told me that my husband was my first boyfriend, so I took that as okay. So this might be an expression of love, right? Not really economic reason or etc. So that's also an important thing. Looking at, let's say, international marriages, current international marriages, right? I think it's also the same because we have the issue of marriage migrants, for instance, and that many think that, especially if you have marriage migrants from developing countries, marrying men of developed countries such as Japan and Korea, they think of it from an economic perspective. Yes, that should not be discounted, but we also have to take into consideration emotions like love, for example, that they also play a part in these marriages. And then in terms of identity, so we see that currently, right, how these foreign women, marriage migrants, how they try to raise their children, maybe adapting a Japanese way of life, or let's say Japanese identity, or their own culture's identity, their own country's identity. And that's what I saw as well for these war brides. And this was like back in the 50s, 60s. So in a way, this issue of international marriages is not new, right? Because it happened even before, albeit in a different context, right? Because of the war. And right now we have these marriage migrants because of a different context and a different issue.
Thank you. Yeah, this is, I guess, in essence, is a bit of a heavy topic, but I'm really glad that your book is bringing this problem, the situation, and the challenges these women face to the world. So thank you for that.
Yes, thank you very much.
And thank you for your time in taking this interview.
Yes, thank you very much for your time as well.
And for our listeners, to learn more about war brides in Okinawa and topics in cross-cultural marriages and migration, make sure to check out this new book, Okinawan Women's Stories of Migration, From War Brides to Issei, by Dr. Johanna Zueta. This is Jin Yi from New Books in Japanese Studies. Please stay tuned for our next episode.